Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, folks. Luke's English podcast is sponsored by iTalki, which is just a really useful service for anyone out there looking for a language partner or a one-to-one teacher to help with any language, really, but certainly English. They have loads and loads of different English teachers with different qualifications and areas of specialization. So go on to iTalki, find a teacher that suits you. You can schedule some lessons very easily through the website. And then before you know it, you're having conversations and lessons with your own teacher right there in your own home through something like Skype. It's really great. So remember that when you buy some lessons, iTalki will then send you a voucher, which is actually worth a free lesson. To get the offer, go to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. You're listening to Luke's English podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, folks. Here's the last of this three-part series I've been doing about quintessentially British things. I'm assuming now that you've heard the previous parts of this series and you know what this is all about. If you haven't heard those yet, may I gently suggest that you listen to them first? There's one with my brother and one with my dad too. Now it's my mum's turn, and since she is such a bookworm, she works in a bookshop, she's a member of a book club, and she is a voracious reader, the three things that she's chosen are all novels. Books about British characters going through typically British experiences, mostly in the early parts of the 20th century. So if you're looking for some interesting books to read in English, check out these ones, which are some of my mum's favourites. Have a look at the page for this episode on the website, where you will find the names of all the books we mention, plus some other references and bits and pieces. Remember, you can sign up to my mailing list on my website to receive an email notification whenever I release a new episode, and that contains a link which will take you straight to the relevant page for that episode. So that's through the email mailing list on the website. Now, without any further ado, let me allow you to enjoy the nice tones of my mum's voice as she talks to you about her quintessentially British things. Okay. Mm. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Luke.
Let me say that again, because you were going, when I said hello, Mum. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Luke.
How are you today?
I'm all right, thank you. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Good.
What have I been... What did I ask you, Dad, and James to think of a few days ago?
You asked us to think of quintessential or archetypal things, English or British things that we could discuss. Mm-hmm. But you didn't really want us to talk about the obvious things that everyone talks about, like tea and fog and Dickens and things like that. Mm-hmm. And Shakespeare.
Yeah,
I would have been happy talking about Shakespeare.
To be honest, me too. I mean, I would have been happy to hear you talking about Shakespeare as well.
Well, we'll do that another day.
Yeah. Okay.
But you wanted things that were a bit different, which is what I struggled with. I was trying to find things that were British, that were British and with no other influences from around the world, and it's very hard.
Well,
I first of all thought of art, because I know a little bit about art, but it seemed to me that most British English art, even though it's very English, like Hogarth and people like that, even they have influences mostly from the continent of Europe.
Yeah.
And architecture, the same thing. A lot of Italian influence in our architecture, and Northern European influences in Gothic and all that sort of thing. So in the end, I ended up thinking about books, which is what I mostly think about anyway.
You're a book person, aren't you?
I am, yeah.
You work in a bookshop.
I work in a bookshop, and I follow lots of book podcasts, and I'm very influenced by one of them, which is called Backlisted, which I would recommend to anyone.
Backlisted podcast.
Yeah.
We have talked about it before.
Yeah.
But just as a reminder, or for those people who haven't heard that conversation, I don't remember what the number of that episode is, but I'll probably put a link to it in the on the page for the episode. But it was, anyway, the podcast that you listen to is called Backlisted. Yeah. Yes. Anyway.
So I thought, okay, I'll concentrate on books, because quite a lot of the books that I read these days tend to be English, very English, but they're not even British, I'm afraid.
So hold on a minute. I mean, I went through this with Dad, like, oh, British
you?
Or English.
Yeah.
Are the things that you've chosen, are they only English, or have you got any Scottish, Welsh or Northern Irish in there?
There's a mention of Welsh. One of the characters in one of the books is Welsh. But mainly they're English, I'm afraid.
Okay. So maybe I should call this. I'm still struggling to work out what to title these episodes, whether I should call them quintessentially English things or quintessentially British things. Mm. But in the end, I've decided it doesn't really matter that much.
As long as we say what they are, I suppose it doesn't matter.
So you've chosen three books?
I think it's three, possibly four.
Okay.
And they tend to be from... Between the Wars, written or the
published.
Subject matter is Between the Wars, you know, 1930s, 40s.
So written or set between the wars.
Yeah, they tend to be.
Okay.
And I realise, of course, that they do tend to, they are influenced by the two world wars, or at least they talk, the subject matter and the characters are people who have been affected in one way or another, by one or both of the world wars.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
How come? I wonder, how can you account for the fact that the three or possibly four books you've chosen all involve characters who've been influenced by the wars then?
I don't know. It's just happened. I started to discover that I enjoyed reading books from that period. And although that period contains a lot of novels and literature in Britain and England, because it covers the modernist period, you know, when Virginia Woolf and all that lot were active. But they, I think you would describe them as highbrow literature.
Virginia Woolf, just remind us, what's the most famous thing that she wrote? It's probably didn't she do the... No. Sorry, I was thinking The Handmaid's Tales, but that's Margaret Atwood.
Different person altogether.
Sorry, revealing my ignorance.
Yeah, no, Virginia Woolf's famous ones are The Voyage Out, is that right? The Waves, To the Lighthouse, Mrs. Dalloway, all those things.
What kind of period of time are we talking about?
1930s, 20s, 30s, I think. Well, actually, I'm showing my ignorance now. maybe the end of the... 19th century, that sort of period.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can fact check that later if necessary.
But anyway, she was one of the modernist novelists. And as I say, they were very highbrow and quite literary. And the ones, the books I've chosen and the books I tend to like to read these days are what you would call middlebrow.
Hmm. What does this mean? Highbrow? Highbrow is the word that is used more often.
Yeah.
I hadn't heard middlebrow before, but what does highbrow mean?
Well, highbrow means literary, intellectual novels and literature.
Yeah.
And middlebrow is, well, you can guess from that, it's not exactly chick lit, you know, very, very basic, easy to read books, but it's not as intellectual as
the highbrow stuff. So it's like somewhere in the middle.
Pop. In the middle, maybe.
Yeah, middlebrow. Yeah. So not the popular, basic, easy to read stuff that you get in airports.
Yeah.
But not the very intellectual highbrow stuff, but somewhere
in the middle.
All right then.
Hmm.
So do you want to start with the first book?
Yes, and I'm trying to work out which one I would start with, and I think I'm going to start with. Now this is interesting. After what I've just said. This is a book written by J.L. Carr, and it was actually written in, I'm not quite sure, but it was written in the 20th century.
We're talking about early 20th century British novels.
Yeah, but this is mid-20s. I was said before that all the books I liked were in the 30s and 40s,
yeah,
but this one is later. I think he wrote it in the 1980s, 70s, 80s.
But
it is set... in Northern England just after the First World War.
Okay.
And it concerns a character who has fought in the First World War, Mr. Birkin, and he is shell-shocked. In other words, he's, you know, a nervous wreck after his experiences in the First World War.
He's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
He is. That's not what they would have called it then. They would have called it shell shock, but it is PTSD, as we would call it now. And he's suffering from it very badly because he came in for a lot of shelling and what have you. It went in the trenches and, you know, he was an officer and he was having to lead his men into horrible situations and came home a complete nervous wreck. And his having come home, his wife has decided that she wants to leave him. She wants to break up the marriage. So that's an added problem that he's dealing with. And he's an artist. His job is uncovering medieval wall paintings. And he has been employed by the vicar of a parish in northern Yorkshire to go along to their church and uncover a medieval masterpiece which has been painted over some years before. And that's kind of the premise of the story. But, of course, what it's really about is it's called A Month in the Country, by the way.
A Month in the Country.
A Month in the Country.
By
J.L. Carr.
Okay.
And the main premise of it is, of course, is that it's him coming to the country in the summer and recovering from his ordeal. It's a very quiet part of the world. Nothing much happens. He meets lots of different people, some of whom are very inspirational, some of whom aren't. Meets nice families who take him to their hearts and, you know, invite him for Sunday lunch and all that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really all about him in the countryside, in the beautiful weather, uncovering this medieval painting, which is what they call a judgment, which often used to be on church buildings. It's an illustration of Christ sitting in majesty with on one side, on his right side, I suppose, people, all the good people ascending into heaven. He is judging everyone as they die.
The people on the right are ascending into heaven.
They're going up into heaven for their reward. And the people who have been bad, I think on his left-hand side, are descending into hell. So you get all these wonderful illustrations of medieval ideas of hell, you know, the jaws of hell and all the horrible little demons receiving all the people who haven't behaved well in their lives.
Sinners.
Hmm.
Okay.
And
so he's recovering from his experiences of combat, dealing with post-traumatic stress disorder, or shell shock, as they called it then.
Yeah.
And his job is to uncover this medieval painting that's been painted over.
And it's a very complicated plot, actually. There's all sorts happening in it.
Mm.
I won't go into the whole thing, but the main part of the book is the fact that he has come to this quiet part of England, beautiful countryside, quiet, very nice people on the whole, and it's a healing experience for him. And his twitch that he has...
A twitch, like a physical...
Yeah.
What is a twitch?
It's a physical muscular contraction on the face, which people tend to develop when they're very, very stressed.
It's like when one eye starts blinking uncontrollably.
Yes, or if your mouth twitches up at one side.
It's like movement in the face that you can't control. You
can't control it, and it's...
associated with trauma and stress.
Yeah. When he first arrives, he's got one of these. But as the story progresses, it becomes less and less. And by the time he leaves, it's pretty well gone.
Ah.
And he's had a letter from his wife saying she's thought again and she'd like to give it a go. So he goes back to his wife feeling much better and sort of healed by his month in the country. It's just a beautiful book, and as I say, there are loads and loads of different plot aspects, but which I won't go into now. But it's really about, you know, the awful effects of war on people and how the English countryside can help to cure it all and heal you.
Yeah, it sounds lovely.
It is one of my favourite books.
How do you feel when you read it? How many times have you read this book?
Oh, golly, I don't know. 10 times, maybe.
Really?
And they also made a film of it with Kenneth Branagh and Colin Firth.
Right.
And it's a beautiful film.
Yeah, I've seen it.
Yes, we watched it.
You showed it to me.
Yeah.
And you're right, it is absolutely beautiful.
And it's very true to the book. The atmosphere and everything is just the same as the book.
Yeah.
So I would recommend anyone, if they come across it, to read it or to see the film.
What's the sort of English like? Is it written in plain English? Or yeah. is it particularly stylized? Is it very old-fashioned language?
That's what I mean when I say it's middlebrow. There's no right. sort of literary tricks or anything like that. Mm. It's written in a very straightforward way. So I imagine people would find it relatively easy to read.
Just tell us the name of the book again.
It's A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr.
Didn't you have some correspondence with J.L. Carr?
Yeah, I did. Because I first read the book in the early 80s, I suppose, and absolutely loved it and wanted to read more of his books. And used to go into bookshops, because in those days there was no Amazon, or you couldn't order books online very easily. Well, you couldn't order them online at all because there was no internet.
Yeah.
And the only way you could find a book was to go into a bookshop. And I would go into bookshops looking for his books and I could never find them. So in the end, I decided I would write to him via his publisher and say, you know, I've been looking for loved your book, loved The Month in the Country, can't find any of your other books. Can you help me? And he replied saying, yes, I've got some here and I can sell you some direct if you like. So he sent me a little postcard, handwritten. So I wrote back and he gave me the list of the books and I wrote back and ordered a couple. And he sent them with another little note, and this continued. I wrote to him a couple of times, two or three times, asking for more books. He also used to produce, he was a quintessentially strange, eccentric Englishman as well,
yeah.
Himself. And one of the other things he used to do, as well as writing novels, was to produce illustrated maps of different counties of England. And I ordered a couple of those as well. And we used to have the one of Yorkshire. And don't know what happened to it. And now, of course, you can't get them. They're out of print because he died a few years ago.
So you don't know what happened to that?
I don't know what happened to that map.
That map of Yorkshire.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
You had it in a frame? Or was
I honestly can't remember. I think actually we bought it for Dad, for your granddad.
Yeah.
But I think I had a copy myself and I don't know what's happened to either of them. It's funny, very bizarre.
Things sort of go missing.
Annoying. Yeah. Very annoying.
I remember that he sent you these little...
postcards.
Well, he sent you postcards, but he also sent you these little books, right? These, how did you do, little pamphlet-style books?
Yeah, that was another thing he used to do. He used to produce them himself, and he would illustrate them himself as well. And there was a lot of them. There was one on Shakespeare, and they just had about 8 pages in each one, with just examples of bits of Shakespeare. He did Shakespeare, he did various poets, you know, Shelley, Donne.
Didn't he do something about cricket?
Yes, he did.
It was like, I just remember a little mini pamphlet about cricket, and it was very, very beautifully illustrated and very, just very sweet and lovely, basically.
Yeah. Well, that was it. That was one of his. That was one of his enthusiasms, cricket. Mm. And I think he did 2 on cricket. I think we've probably got them around here somewhere.
But there you go. So the healing power of the English countryside.
And the Yorkshire countryside on top of that.
Okay, because you're from Yorkshire as well.
I am.
Dad comes from Yorkshire and so do you originally.
That's right, yes.
Okay, very interesting stuff.
So that's a beautiful book. And another book which is kind of similar in its subject matter, in that it is about a young man who is, you know, coming back from the First World War, who's also shell-shocked and in a terrible state.
So this is book number two.
This is book number two. This is called To Serve Them All My Days by E.F. Delderfield.
Sorry, say the title again, please.
To Serve Them All My Days.
To Serve Them All My Days.
Which is referring to a schoolmaster. It's what a schoolmaster is saying, serving... So it's referring to serving the students all his days, or serving the school all his days. In other words, he will always be someone. I'm trying to find my notes that I wrote on it now, and I can't find them.
But it's about a schoolmaster.
Well, it's about him coming home from the war and being in the same sort of state as the character in J.L. Carr's book, and. Only this man, I suppose this brings a little bit of Britishness into it because this man happens to be a Welshman called David Powlett Jones.
That's the character.
That's the character. And Powlett Jones answers an advert. He comes home from war in a real state, very, very shocked and suffering from PTSD after the First World War. And he answers an advert to become a teacher in a little... private school in Devon somewhere, And he has no experience of teaching at all, but he goes along for an interview, and he is he's not a public school person himself either. He's a miner's son from Wales.
Just from a very working...
So he's from a working class background, and this public school, it's only a small one, but it would cater for people who were of a higher class than that. So he wouldn't be the automatic choice for a schoolmaster in a school like that.
Yeah.
But he goes along and he is interviewed by the headmaster, who's one of these really lovely, caring, old school type of people.
You mean old fashioned?
Old fashioned.
But in a good way.
Yes, that's right. With old fashioned values and very gentle and caring and what have you. And he interviews this young man and discovers that he has, you know, he's got something about him. And so he decides to employ him. And it's just nothing, well, I was going to say nothing very drastic happens, but of course it does. It's a bit sort of like a saga. It's the saga of David's life,
yeah,
and how he settles in the school and begins to love it. And it talks a lot about the school children, school boys, because of course they're all boys.
Yeah.
And how he gets on with them, even though they come from a different class from him, and how he manages to get everyone's respect, even some of the school teachers who look down on him because of who he is. He manages to gain their respect eventually because he's a decent guy. And he gets married and has a family, and then there's a tragedy. His wife is killed, and
spoiler alert.
Yeah, there is quite a lot of drama in it, I suppose. But you would say, really, it's just it's a gentle sort of book.
Because when you said earlier that these books were all sort of related to war, some people might have thought that you were into like. Books about fighting?
Absolutely not. I hate all that idea of war. Can't bear reading about that sort of thing. But I mean, I find these books fascinating because it shows the effect that war has on people and how terrible it is.
Yeah.
It's just a long book. It's a very long book. But it's a book that you can really get stuck into. You really get involved in it.
Yeah.
And it's about his life in the school. Basically, that's all it is. But, you know, the same with J.L. Carr's book. He gradually recovers from his awful experience. But, of course, the elephant in the room.
Ooh, nice.
I don't know if your students know that expression.
My students?
Your listeners, sorry.
No, that's all right. They kind of are my students too, I suppose.
The elephant in the room means it's a metaphor for addressing... A sort of a subject or a theme that is hovering in the background that nobody refers to. But the elephant in the room in this book, of course, is the fact that you know that the Second World War is going to happen fairly soon.
I see.
So you know that he is recovering from the First World War, and he's recovering from the school is recovering from all the deaths of the boys, from the old boys from school who died in the trenches in the First World War. As the years go by, you realise that they were getting very close to 1939, when, of course, war starts again. And, of course, at the end of the book, he has become the headmaster, and he is now seeing, hearing news of old boys that he used to teach who've been killed in the war. So it's kind of circular.
History and, repeating itself.
Yeah, and sad.
Circular. It's interesting that you mention a circular narrative.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that James mentioned was also a circular narrative.
Really? To do with what?
Which one was it? It was Batman.
Oh.
The Killing Joke. Batman story by Alan Moore.
Ah.
And basically that's all about how... I don't know because I haven't read it, but what I understood was that essentially we get the idea that... The first frame of the novel, or something like this, the first frame of the graphic novel is also the last frame. And so it's kind of like you just arrive back at the beginning again. Because, you know, Batman is, a lot of that is about vengeance.
Yes.
About wanting revenge and about taking justice into your own hands, being a vigilante and trying to avenge a childhood trauma that, you know, Bruce Wayne, who is, I'm not going to talk about this for long because this is your episode, but Bruce Wayne as a child, his parents are murdered. In some versions of the story, his parents are murdered by a criminal who later becomes the Joker. who is Batman's arch nemesis.
Yes.
And so the two of them are, you know, arch... What's the plural of nemesis?
I don't know.
Nemesises?
Nemesi?
It's not a problem that we often deal with, is it?
It isn't.
The plural of nemesis. But anyway, no. They are arch enemies.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, again, I haven't read it, but maybe what happens is at the beginning, you know, the Batman is created by some act of violence, and at the end of the film, of the story, somehow the Batman is created again by another bit of violence. And the idea that, you know, revenge just creates a cycle of violence that goes round and round. Mm. And I don't know if there are any parallels here, but something to do with the way that history repeats itself.
Yeah, and how sad it is that, you know, he builds himself back up to full fitness and teaches all these boys and has wonderful relationships with them, and they all go off and do things in life. And then, of course, you know, war repeats itself, and he gets news of a lot of these boys who he nurtured through school having been killed in the Second World War.
Yeah.
So, you know, there could easily be a person like him turning up at the school to see him, asking if he'll give him a job because he's traumatised after the Second World War.
Like, yeah. You can imagine later on, Yeah, the another traumatised person coming to the school trying to find work. And yes, interesting.
Yeah.
So that was called again, sorry?
That was called To Serve Them All My Days. And it's, as I say, it's what does it say here in my notes? It says from Wikipedia, it says, it portrays the sweep of English history and delves deeply into social history from the Edwardian era to the early 1960s. So...
I'm kind of getting a kind of Downton Abbey vibe from that.
Well, yes. I mean, it is a big thing in our history, in English history.
That period.
Going back to the Edwardian era, where everyone said it was the golden era, you know, before the wars came along and spoiled everything. There is an element of that. But in this particular book, it starts after the First World War. So you don't get much of an idea of the... golden age from it.
Yeah. Okay. But that's the similar sort of period.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Right.
Very interesting.
I suppose.
Book number three.
Tricky. I think I'm going to go for a book by R.C. Sheriff. You know about R.C. Sheriff, don't you?
R.C. Sheriff. she wrote a... It's a she, isn't it?
No, it's a he.
Oh, whoops. No, so then I don't know about R.C.
Well,
Sheriff.
Wrote
oh, yes, I do. Okay, yeah. So there's a With Nail and I reference here, because R.C. Sheriff is one of the characters in With Nail and I at the end of the film. This is a film, listeners. I did an episode about With Nail and I with James. Check the archive for that one. It'll help you understand what we're talking about, and you should just know about the film. It's brilliant. But at the end, one of the characters is reading a novel by R.C.
No, he's not reading the novel.
Oh.
They're both actors. With Nail and I, the I character, Marwood.
Yeah.
They're both actors. And at the end, Marwood gets a job as an actor, because both he and With Nail have been waiting for their agents to come up with some work for them. And, of course, With Nail doesn't get any. But Marwood, at the end, is offered a part in a play called...
Journey's End,
which is written by R.C. Sheriff.
Well, he is reading it, though, at the end of the
film. Oh, yes, well, he's reading the play script. In preparation for going off to be in the play.
All I know is that he puts a book into his suitcase and it's Journey's End by R.C. Sheriff.
Right. And I've got that same book.
Have you really?
Yeah.
With the same cover?
The same cover.
And he's reading the book or
It's the play script. It's a play.
Because
it's about the First World War. It's about the men in the First World War in the trenches.
Okay.
And there's been a film made of it, which is very good. You should see it sometime.
Journey's End. So anyway R.C. Sheriff
is famous mainly for that play. But he's also written several novels, which are all different from each other. In fact, I gave you one of them. I don't suppose you've read it, called The Hopkins Manuscript.
No, I haven't read it yet. But
and it's really good. That is a very good, quirky English book.
It's a science fiction, isn't it?
It is. effectively science fiction, but it's really, well, I suppose like a lot of science fiction, it's really about just about people and the way people react to weird things happening.
I think you gave me that book, well, because obviously because you really love the work of R.C. Sherriff, yeah. But also you know how much I love War of the Worlds.
Yes, it's a similar feel to the War of the Worlds.
H.G. Wells, yeah. Story about an alien invasion, a Martian invasion. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, tell us about this particular
book. But the one that of his that I really love is called The Fortnight in September.
Okay.
And you could say that nothing much happens in it. It's just about a family, the mother, the father, and three children, a young boy, a teenage girl, and a teenage boy. And they go off to Bognor Regis every year in September for a fortnight for their holiday.
Bognor Regis.
Bognor Regis is in Sussex.
Okay.
And it's a sort of quintessential English seaside town of the early 20th century.
Okay.
And it just follows them getting ready in their house in Dulwich, I think, in London, getting ready in their house, packing their stuff and getting ready. And the mother is a very nervy character. She hasn't got much self-confidence and she's worried about the journey and everything. It just goes into that and it goes into all the preparations that they make. And the fact that they have to go off to the station in a taxi, they get the train. And when they're on the train, they look out of the window and the train goes along the bottom of their garden. And there's a wonderful scene where they look at their own garden from the train, you know, and they all see different things.
So wait, it's a family preparing to go on a little holiday, yep, to Bognor Regis on the south coast.
Yes.
The father of the family, the patriarch of the family, has come back from World War One.
Well, no, that's not mentioned at all. I mean, it is similar in that it is set in the period between the two world wars.
Yeah,
but the world wars aren't really. I don't think they're referred to at all.
So
but
it's
you know that there's a feeling of the father just enjoying his rather mundane existence, doing his gardening, and it. That's why I mentioned the scene of them in the train and seeing the garden as they go past and how he looks with pride on his garden and how pleased he is that the dahlias are doing well and all that sort of thing. And you just read between the lines and you know that he is just very happy living in his house with not much happening, with his wife and his family, doing his garden, going off to work every day, coming back home, planning his holiday, going off on the train to the same boarding house that they always stay in.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is just very similar to the way it's always been. And it's presumably what he would have been looking forward to going back to after the war. It's not made explicit, but just have that feeling all the way through.
There's this implications the man is enjoying what might appear to be a very boring, yeah, mundane existence, yeah, but for him it's a therapeutic,
yes,
existence.
It's the simple, normal things that he would have wanted, that he would have looked forward to returning to when he was in the trenches or whatever.
So, but in terms of storyline, is there a lot of storyline going
on?
Well,
there isn't really. You could say, I mean, I gave it to a friend hoping that she would enjoy it, and she actually admitted that she thought it was boring because not much happened. And I suppose not much does happen apart from the fact that they go on holiday and they sit on the beach and they make the big decision to rent a beach hut this year, which they don't always do. And they sit in the beach hut and they watch all the other people going by and doing what they're doing, and they eat picnic lunches. And the younger boy has a wonderful time, uncomplicated time, paddling in the sea, making sandcastles and all that sort of thing. The girl, of course, meets a boy and has to try and find ways of meeting him and going to the pictures and going to dances with him and everything when she knows her parents don't really approve of it. And the older boy is, he must be nearly 20, must be almost in his 20s because he's got a job. But he's feeling very dissatisfied and he wants better. He knows that he wants better in his life and he's making plans to, you know, this often happens when you're on holiday. Mm. You're away from home and it gives you space to think about your life and what you want to do. And even though his parents are very happy with their settled, uneventful rather boring and normal life. He wants something better than the job that he's already got, and he's making plans to change his direction in life. And you know that you know he's going to go home and start preparing for that change, but you soon realise, I think it's set, this novel is set in 1937, 38, something like that. And of course it suddenly occurs to you that Second World War is around the corner, and you know that this young man is of the age that he will immediately become involved in it all. He'll be called up or he'll volunteer, and you know all his plans will probably come to nothing.
He
might even die. Yeah. And so it's very touching, you know, watching these people having their very boring little holiday and enjoying their rather boring, normal little lives.
So it might appear to be, like your friend said, a boring story about a family going on holiday.
Yeah.
But the context and your knowledge of the context allows you to read between the lines and see all the implied details.
Yeah.
Can I ask how is the story told? Is it
It's a third person omniscient narrator.
A third person omniscient narrator.
So the narrator describes what's happening. You don't actually hear, as far as I can remember, you don't actually see it from. It's the narrator describing what the boy feels like, what the girl feels like, what the girl wants to do, what the boy wants to do. You don't actually hear the voice of the boys or the girls.
Yeah, so it's not told through the eyes of one of the characters.
No. There's a third-person narrator telling the story.
It's a bit like sort of observing this family then.
Yes, that's right.
And I think you're quite an observant person. I mean, you know, Dad would say that you tend to do lots of people watching.
Yeah, yeah.
So if we go out to a cafe or some public place, you will sit there quietly. And if you know, for example, if I pay attention to you or if we notice you, you'll be sitting there quietly, but you'll be observing everyone around you, having a look at what people on the other tables, working out their stories. And you're very good at that, like observing other people and working out what's going on. And so this sort of story really suits you.
Yes,
I think.
I expect that's
where there's,
right.
There's a lot of implied detail.
Yes.
And it's, you know, the account of what's happening could appear to be very boring. But when you're, when you have the context and if you're observant enough, then you can see what's really going on.
That's right.
Yeah, reading between the
lines. There is a distance between you and the person in the story.
Yeah.
So you're not getting it unmediated from the boy's mind or the father's mind or whatever.
Yeah. And this is also written in a sort of plain English, I suppose, as well, right?
Yeah.
All of the stories you're talking about are written in a kind of, not simple English, but certainly a plain,
straightforward
modern form of English.
No literary tricks or anything.
And not old-fashioned language like you get in Shakespeare or even sort of Jane Austen stuff, which is like very kind of highfalutin language.
Well, it's language of the time, but this is very much modern 20th century language.
Yeah.
With no, as I say, no literary tricks or cleverness or anything, just pretty plainly told.
Could you tell us the name of the story again and the writer?
It's The Fortnight in September by R.C. Sheriff.
Fortnight, obviously meaning 2 weeks.
2 weeks.
Ladies and gentlemen. Okay, The Fortnight in September by R.C. Sheriff.
Yeah.
And the other thing we mentioned there is R.C. Sheriff's play called Journey's End. Which is featured in the film With Nell and I.
That's right.
Okay. And always, With Nell and I always comes up in our family, doesn't it, in one way or another?
It tends to,
Now, you said that it would be three, maybe four books.
Well, I think we'll make it through. I've talked about two so far, have I?
You've done three.
Have I?
Yeah, you did A Month in the Country.
Oh, yes.
You did.
To Serve Them All My Days and The Fortnight in September. Well, we can probably leave it at that, if you're happy with that.
Well,
because
they're all
books of a similar theme, really, aren't they?
Odd numbers are usually better in this kind of thing.
Yeah.
So three. We'll stick with three. Okay. And we'll leave the fourth one as a sort of mystery cliffhanger. Like, well, I wonder what the fourth one was.
Well, the fourth one I was going to talk about is completely different, really.
We'll save that one for another time. Don't mention it.
It's not on the. It doesn't have the same theme, really. So we'll leave that one.
We'll leave that one as a sort of.
In fact, there are one or two others I could talk about on the same theme as this next one that I was going to talk about.
Okay. Well, we can leave that for another episode for another time.
Yeah.
Another episode of what? What we're going to call it? Mum's Book Club.
Maybe.
Jill's Book Club. And we've got the Rick Thompson Report.
Oh, yeah.
I think
yeah.
you need a series as well. So okay. we call them Jill's Book Club or something.
Maybe.
I'm just curious as to, I mean, I sort of asked you this question earlier. It's just interesting that you've chosen to talk about men who've come back from war leading what looked like potentially sort of fairly straightforward, ordinary lives. But under the surface, there's a lot of stuff going on and, yeah. and that these men are dealing with a lot of trauma. Yeah. Why is it that that's interesting for you?
I don't know. It just has been recently. Thought a lot about, I mean, I don't know. There's always the risk. I suppose because everything is so unsettled here at the moment and you just wonder what's going to happen and people keep making apocalyptic predictions that, you know, we might have a return of what happened in the Second World War the way some people are going.
Yeah, you're very concerned, as we all are, about the way things are going in the world and the possibility of there being another sort of conflict or some kind of I don't know if it would be the same as it was though in those days, because you know
it wouldn't be the same,
all the technology has changed, but you're basically concerned about some other kind of big damaging war of some kind or the return of demagoguery in the world.
It's awful. And I don't know, I suppose I often think about my dad, you know, who served in the Second World War and had what they call a very active war, and I'm sure the older I get, the more I realise how much he was affected by the war. Mm-hmm. And I realise that mainly men, but anybody who is involved in that kind of conflict, mm-hmm. you know, including the more modern conflicts like Afghanistan and Syria and all these things, you know, they must all be damaged, all these people who come home from these conflicts. Yeah. And it's just, I don't know, I find it extremely worrying. It's also a very interesting subject, of course, but, it's happened, it's always happened that young men have gone off and been damaged. If they haven't been killed, they've been damaged probably for good by their experiences. And it's just, I find it quite appalling that we can actually do that to young men. But anyway, it's getting all a bit grim now, isn't it? So.
Yeah, okay. Well, I suppose I should just say thank you.
Okay, well, I don't know how interesting that was, but... Well,
I found it fascinating.
Oh, good.
It's lovely to I mean, it's, you know, one of the things that is nice about having a podcast like this.
That makes us talk about things.
That has an audience. It gives me an excuse to sit down with someone for, you know, half an hour or so and just have a proper conversation with them.
Yeah.
You know, so that's very nice, Mum. Thank you for talking to us about those three books.
Okay.
Very interesting stuff.
All right.
Okay, well, great. A Happy New Year as well.
Oh, same to you and to all your listeners, as they say.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Happy New Year, everybody. All right.
Let's hope it is.
Yeah, a happy, happy year as it becomes less and less new as we move into February, March.
Yeah.
Let's hope things are happy. fingers crossed.
I can't say I have much hope, but there you go.
Well, okay.
Anyway. Here we go, back onto a grim subject.
On that happy note, we'll say goodbye then, shall we?
All right then.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
So that was my mum and her three books. Let me say the titles again. There was A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr, To Serve Them All My Days by R.F. Delderfield, and The Fortnight in September by R.C. Sheriff. It's sort of a funny coincidence that all the writers of these books have initials at the start of their name. J.L. Carr, R.F. Delderfield, R.C. Sheriff. Maybe that's just how people were known in those days, but it seems like a coincidence to me. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed listening to that and that you learned a thing or two about the effects of the world wars on British people, and also that you might consider reading one of those novels yourself. What do you think of my mum talking about books on this podcast? What do you think of that? We did several episodes before together in which we talked a bit about books. There was episode 488 and also 489. You can find those in the archive, both of which dealt with things like my mum's favourite podcast, some favourite people of hers, and different books that she's been reading. So what would you think of a fairly regular podcast series with my mum in which she talks about books she's read? It could also, it could be called Mum's Book Club. If you like the sound of that, let me know. I might be able to make it a regular feature, a bit like the Rick Thompson Report. And yes, I need to make a new one of those since the election. So anyway, would you like to hear more episodes of Mum's Book Club? If so, let me know. But that's it for this episode. What did you think overall of this series? Did you learn anything about the UK? Did you get some good recommendations? Did you enjoy listening to my family? Let me know in the comments section. I'll speak to you again soon. Don't forget to download the Luke's English Podcast app from the App Store to get loads of bonus episodes, and also consider signing up to my premium service to get regular monthly grammar, vocab and pronunciation lessons. To find out more about that, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium. But for now, all that remains to be said is goodbye. Bye, 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 bye. Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.